Coming up on Tech News Today, the president vetoes Samsung's patent win. Feedly starts charging for RSS. And you can apply for a new job on LinkedIn right from your phone. But if you're that lazy, do you deserve the job? We'll talk about that and more next on Tech News Today.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Monday, August 5th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by TechServe. TechServe assists U.S. businesses of all sizes with their technology needs, including Apple, Avid, Adobe, and HP solutions. Visit TechServe.com/TNT and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. And by Shutterstock.com. With over 26 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code TNT8. And by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting, pay for what you use, doesn't require a contract, and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit TNT.Ting.com. That's TNT.Ting.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zakhtar.
And I'm Chad Johnson.
And this is the show where we say Jason Howell's off for a couple days, but Chad's got it under control. And we're going to talk about all the greatest technology news, starting with the news. Microsoft told The Verge that between August 4th and August 29th, customers in Canada, China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the United States will pay $100 less for the Surface Pro. That's about a 10% drop, much less than the 30% drop of the Surface RT. That has some suspecting this price drop may be less about saving sales and more about moving inventory in front of an expected Surface 2.
Samsung is ready to unveil what it says is the next Galaxy in Berlin on September 4th. Invitations went out, and though they don't specify which Galaxy we may see, the consensus is that it's the Galaxy Note 3, especially since the invitation is kind of a hand-drawn written style, which points to the Galaxy Note's standout characteristic, which is an S Pen stylus.
If you were panicking that you wouldn't be able to get some Apple products due to the ITC banning them, fear not, the Obama administration officially vetoed the ruling, citing policy considerations of standard essential patents and promoting innovation as it relates to the effect of competitive conditions in the U.S. economy and the effect on U.S. consumers. Samsung issued a statement saying it is disappointed by the veto.
LinkedIn has introduced the ability to apply for a job from within its mobile app using a LinkedIn profile as a resume. Businesses listing the job offering can choose not to accept the profile and link you out to their own website for a traditional resume. Competitors like CareerBuilder and Monster.com already allow applications on their apps.
Last Friday, Aaron Marquez, a 28-year-old Dublin resident, was arrested on a warrant from the U.S. on charges that he, in the words of the FBI, is the largest facilitator of child porn on the planet. The arrest coincides with the disappearance of a large number of hidden services hosted on Tor, the anonymizing encrypted network. Marquez is alleged to be the founder of Freedom Hosting, which is a major hidden services hosting provider. He's also been connected to the service, as well as the Tor Mail anonymized email service and a Bitcoin exchange and escrow service called Onion Bank. All of those services are now offline.
Today, Google introduced its Android Device Manager service. It will help users find a missing or stolen device. Now, Android Device Manager can help you find your phone by ringing the device, even if it's on silent mode, or locating the device on a map. If you can't reclaim your device, the service will let you wipe all the data on your phone. Android Device Manager will roll out to users of Android 2.2 and higher later this month.
If you use Feedly as your RSS reader and wish you had features like search available, you're in luck, as long as you have $5 and live in the United States. Feedly Pro for $5 a month or $45 a year, or already gone, $99 lifetime memberships to the first 5,000 who signed up for it today, give you search, HTTPS browsing, one-click save to Evernote, and premium support. Feedly promises to keep adding features to the free version. The lifetime accounts are all sold out. The monthly and annual plans will come later this autumn.
Samsung's rumored to be unveiling a smartwatch soon, and according to the company's trademark filing with the United States Patent and Trademark Office, the device could be called the Galaxy Gear. And it might happen pretty soon. Actually, a report in the Korean media last week said that Samsung is expected to unveil this smartwatch along with that possible Galaxy Note 3 at the IFA 2013 in Berlin on September 4th.
A startup called Crossbar announced its version of RRAM, resistive random access memory, and claims 20 times faster write performance, 20 times less power consumption, and 10 times more durability than NAND flash. A 1 terabyte RRAM module will be half the size of an equivalent NAND module. CEO George Manasian estimates RRAM will be cheaper than NAND, though he wouldn't estimate a price. Instead of transistors, RRAM uses three layers with a switch in the middle to determine the one or the zero. Chips can be made in existing factories, but aren't expected to be in commercial production for like 2 to 3 years.
The Chinese government is investigating plants owned by Unimicron and Foxconn for pollution concerns. Now, both companies are Apple suppliers. Chinese regulators are looking into allegations that the two companies pumped large amounts of toxic materials into nearby rivers.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by TechServe, New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and technology provider. But you don't have to be in New York to use them. They serve professionals at all levels, individual customers, Fortune 100 companies, the whole shebang. They carry a full range of Apple products, your iPhones, your iPads, your MacBooks, your iMacs, iPods, and accessories. And TechServe has a range of partnerships with top vendors to facilitate flexible, efficient, and creative solutions for any kind of business needs you got. Tech services, businesses of all sizes. They've most famously, we've talked about their Delta terminals at LaGuardia, at Toronto, in Minneapolis, where they have an iPad at every seat in the terminal. You can check your email, you can order food, get your flight updates. All of that was rolled out by TechServe. Over 1.5 million visitors use these iPads. TechServe helped out OTG Management. They're the company that is behind Delta's terminals. And TechServe was the natural place to serve. They sell support, personalize, configure, manage massive iPad projects, or even small businesses like yours. TechServe also provides ongoing support. So if you ever have a problem in your enterprise, helps just a phone call away. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success? You don't want not success. Use the world's most experienced partner. If your business is considering integrating iOS technology at your workplace, contact TechServe today and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. It's TechServe.com/TNT. And TechServe will help you assess your current or future iPad needs, give you the advice to make it a success. That's TechServe.com/TNT. We thank TechServe for their support of Tech News Today. And joining us now to get into the roundtable discussion of some of the stories in the news today, very happy to have Chris Ziegler, senior editor of The Verge. Hey, Chris, I've had you on Forecast once, but I don't think we ever had you on Tech News Today before.
This is a first. This is a first. Very excited to be here.
I'm very excited to have America's premier Twitter poster on the show.
I try. I do my best.
You do. You follow it up.
It's a lot of pressure.
Z Power. Let's start off talking about that ITC ban. Saturday, a letter to Irving A. Williamson, who's the chairman of the U.S. ITC, from a U.S. trade representative. It was Michael Froman. He was making the decision on behalf of the president. The order comes directly from the president, but the trade representative sort of made the decision. Said, because of the effect on competitive conditions in the U.S. economy and the effect on U.S. consumers, they were going to veto the ITC ban against the 3GS, the 4, the iPad 3G, the iPad 2 3G, over that standards essential patent about 3G connectivity. Apple, of course, applauded the decision. Samsung, of course, did not applaud the decision. That's understandable. South Korea's Ministry of Trade even weighed in and said, we expressed concerns about the negative impact that such a decision would have on the protection of patent rights. There's an upcoming decision where Apple is suing Samsung. That decision has been delayed by the ITC until August 9th. Be interesting to see how they treat that in light of the Obama veto. And a lot of people are saying, well, with the president vetoing this, does that put a chilling effect on bringing these sorts of cases to the ITC? Samsung could still go to court and sue Apple, saying they're not paying enough for the standards essential patent. But a lot of people like to go to the ITC because it's faster and easier. Chris, do you think this will have an effect? If so, what?
Well, I do think it's going to be really interesting to see what effect this has, not just on Samsung's future cases, but on the entire industry. Is, if it gets to this point, is President Obama or whoever happens to be in office going to treat other companies the same way that he treated Apple? Because Apple obviously is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And it's our hometown phone and computer manufacturer, so to speak. So, you know, did that have an effect? We don't know. But, you know, Washington has been signaling for, geez, what, a year now, that it's going to start kind of turning the tables on patent trolls and other, you know, forms of court actions that are gumming up the works. And I think that we're going to be seeing more and more of this.
Yeah, looking at the letter, I was the major thing that I noticed was actually in a footnote talking about when exclusion orders are still would be appropriate. Because in the letter that explains the veto, it seems like the reason why this wasn't going through is because Apple and Samsung were negotiating. So if they didn't have any payments, or if there's a refusal to negotiate, then you could still have an exclusion under this letter. I don't think this has any kind of like precedential value. But if you do show that the administration is willing to veto things that are outside of these listed items, although this letter says this is not an exclusive list, then you might have a change in behavior at the ITC, but it still keeps the door open for exclusion orders in general.
Yeah, and a lot of people are saying, why is the president getting involved here? Well, that's the way the ITC works. You don't have to take your matter to the ITC. You can go to court, and then the president can't be involved. You go to the ITC because you think it's faster and more efficient, and the president has final review over those decisions in that venue. So they rarely exercise it, but this is perfectly the way it's supposed to work, is the president is the one who says, well, wait a minute, this is a case where this shouldn't happen. Now, it'll be interesting with Apple's case on Friday. If they say, well, this isn't a standards essential issue, they would have a basis to not veto a decision that went against Apple. And yet we're probably still going to hear Samsung and Korea cry foul over that.
Yeah, these two are going to go back and forth. It seems like indefinitely anyway. Any venue they can find that actually is friendly towards Samsung, Samsung will go to. Friendly to Apple, they go to there. ITC is now looking like it's not going to be the favored venue by anybody because of this kind of order. Because if any company really wants to enforce a ban, they have to go through the court process instead of going through the ITC, whose decisions aren't necessarily final until like a long time. And you see it's vetoable, right? It can be removed if the president determines that. And if, again, like Tom was saying, if people are wondering why the president can do this, they even lay this out in the letter, which if you want to take a nap, I suggest reading the letter because it's very, very legal. It feels like law school again, but it does tell you the section in which they have power to do such things. So give it a read if you want.
And to be fair, I think that this is less likely to happen with less cash-rich rich companies. But when you look at Samsung and Apple in particular, their coffers are just so deep that they can just go at each other indefinitely in any venue they choose. And so, you know, I'm sure that as long as these two guys are at the top, these kinds of things are going to happen. And they're going to be trying different ways of going about it. They're going to be going to different venues.
Yeah, PricewaterhouseCoopers pointed out patent cases in the U.S. jumped 30% in 2012. So I think the administration is also trying to figure out how to slow these things down. They've been working on patent reform. And people argue a lot about whether it's any kind of effective patent reform or not. But this is another tool that they have to put a kind of a slowing effect on this sort of thing. Let's talk about getting jobs, Sarah.
Yeah, let's do it.
I don't even have to use a typewriter anymore. I can just use my smartphone.
That's true, Tom. You're right on track. Actually, so last month, LinkedIn started letting users search for jobs via their mobile apps on iOS and Android. Now, when you find a job that you feel is just your dream job, or at least good enough, or maybe you just need any job at all, you can use your LinkedIn profile as a resume and apply for a job that you see via mobile. Now, LinkedIn, there's a few reasons for that. They've got job searches making up over 30% now of LinkedIn's total mobile traffic, so they know that this is actually something that people are doing. It's also kind of nice to be able to use your LinkedIn profile because if you think about the idea of formatting anything on your smartphone, especially something like a resume, that's sort of a headache, so it's something that's already put in place. I've always had a LinkedIn profile, even though I don't really use most of what LinkedIn provides as services to me. I don't really read any articles on LinkedIn. I don't use it as a social network for the most part. But I feel like if somebody actually wants to look at my resume, everything that I've ever done in my career, then that's where it is. My resume is always up to date, or hopefully up to date there. So I think it makes a lot of sense for LinkedIn to be able to offer this capability. But I wonder how convenient this is for, especially in larger enterprise companies, how convenient it is to sort of be getting this boilerplate LinkedIn type resume for a job that might be wanted by a large bunch of people. Or maybe it's just a streamlined process that everybody gets something out of. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, maybe I'm just a dinosaur, but from my perspective, if I'm applying for a job, I want to put some TLC into the resume, into the cover letter. I want it to be like a really, you know, kind of warm and personal conversation with the recruiter or whoever I'm speaking to. And this takes all of that out of the equation. It just makes it a very sterile, you know, here's my LinkedIn profile. Do you want me or not? And I don't know. I mean, if I'm taking a job seriously, am I really going to be doing it from my smartphone in the first place? I think I'll still be using a laptop, but maybe I'm obsolete here. I don't know.
I don't know if I agree with you, because I remember I spent about 8 months unemployed, and I know every opportunity I had, either with my phone or with a laptop or whatever, I was scouring jobs and trying to find it. So whatever device you have, if you've got to go out grocery shopping and you're waiting in line, you want to apply to every single job you can. It seemed ridiculous that you had to format everything specific for each company. If LinkedIn can become the default, I guess, resume gate kind of thing, you just go, okay, I'll just go right to resume. This is their resume through LinkedIn, and then I can craft a cover letter or something that's personal. Because for the most part, a lot of these guys can just decide right off your resume, oh, you don't have enough experience. You can write a cover letter and that might help. But a lot of these companies just look at just flat out facts. And if you don't match their 3 to 5 years of experience or whatever it may be, you can move faster. If anything, I would love to see LinkedIn have one of those Domino's pizza style, okay, they've read your resume. They're considering your resume. They have rejected your resume, which I have seen for months and months, 8 months of pain.
I just feel like this is, in many ways, why people, you know, Ayaz and I were talking about this last week. It's like sometimes people will surface on LinkedIn and wanting to be contacts, and you're like, they're looking for a job. And so maybe it just makes it just a little bit more obvious to everybody. This is a place where you search for jobs. You make contacts with people that maybe you worked with in the past, maybe work at the place that you desire to work. So it all just, it's putting it out there, you know, a little bit more bluntly that this is a tool to get new jobs. So
yeah,
make your resume awesome and use LinkedIn to apply.
I wonder on the hiring manager side, I think that determines whether this service ends up being a success or not. If the hiring manager finds that it gets them better applicants and makes better hires, then it will totally catch on. That seems obvious to say. But the question is, and going back to what Chris said, do they want those weed out factors of like, oh, this is a really nicely done resume and a great written cover letter? Or will they say, you know, I was only ever using those weed out factors as a proxy because it was hard to get a whole really, you know, good comparison side by side of what people were worth. But if everybody's got the same LinkedIn profile stats, then you can weed out a bunch of people right at the beginning because they just don't meet the minimum requirements and say, okay, these are the people with the most experience and the best type of experience that I want. It probably depends on the job. I mean, Chris and I, we're thinking of jobs in media and where it isn't as quantifiable. Whereas if you're an engineering person and you're looking like, do they have certs and this, and this, that weeds out a lot of people pretty fast.
Right. Yeah. In some industries, you can imagine that this will completely, if this catches on, it'll completely upend the way people are hired. And it'll become much, much more, I kind of equate it, well, I equate everything in my life to smartphones. I think of it as comparing two spec sheets for two smartphones, right? Versus getting to know somebody, getting to know everything about them. And is that good? Maybe in some businesses and maybe in other businesses, it's not.
So you're saying the Moto X would not want to apply for a job through this because it's not about the specs for it.
That's exactly right.
It needs the warm cover letter approach.
Right.
All right. Let's talk about Feedly starting to charge some money. They have to make money somehow. What do we think, Ayaz?
A simple story that Tom recapped in the news for you. So we got Feedly Pro introduced in the U.S., $5 per month or $45 a year. It gives you features like HTTPS support, search, so you can search articles within your feed, Evernote integration, supposed to be like one click to be able to put things in your Evernote notebooks, premium support, which means pro users get to bump other people who are using the free version of Feedly. They get support first before the other folks. And there was, for a very short time, a $99 lifetime option limited to the first 5,000 claimants.
Those I totally did it.
All
I
gone.
Snapped it up as soon as I heard about it.
Well, back when Google Reader was announced to be killed, right? Everyone was like, oh, I can't believe this is happening. And some people were claiming, I would pay for Google Reader. Now, this freemium model, very much like Evernote and a lot of other services out there, Chris, do you see a lot of people acting like Tom, just throwing money at Feedly because they want to keep a service going?
You know, I don't know. I genuinely don't know. This entire RSS reader hullabaloo this year has really been, I think, one of the most fascinating technology stories in a long, long time, because you have this 800-pound gorilla of the business phasing out what is apparently, you know, it kind of signals the death of RSS, or at least that's what they'd have you believe. And then from those ashes, you have all these services like Feedly and NewsBlur kind of springing up out of nowhere, and a lot of people trumpeting those services. But I don't know, you know, it's a question of, are we looking at a vocal minority, or is this genuinely something that a lot of people are interested in? And I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, I think that this is something Feedly needed to do. Search is obviously a very, very important feature. I'm sure that the Evernote integration is going to get some traction. But I don't know. It's going to be fascinating to see. We'll have to follow up with them and see what they say.
I think Feedly's just experimenting with, hey, if a very small portion of the very, very vocal community of people who love Google Reader and, you know, were going to fall down and die if somebody didn't pick it up once it went away, small number of those people convert into paying customers, you make potentially a lot of money, even though most of the people never will. I mean, I look at all of this and I'm like, I guess there's some perks. I'm not really incentivized to pay because I like Feedly as it is, and I don't feel like I'm really missing out. I've never felt very, very unsafe without lockdown browsing. That said,
don't go,
I mean,
into
why
your
not
news
just try?
Folder alone, Sarah. It's not safe.
You know what I mean, though. It's this. I mean, this seems like, why wouldn't Feedly experiment with this? If they don't make any money, maybe they go, okay, well, people don't really want to pay for the things that we were offering. What else can we offer that makes a pro version look attractive?
I paid for the $99 version because I do really enjoy using Feedly and I want to support them. But I have two big criticisms. One is the search should be there already. That has been frustrating me since I switched from Google Reader. And now I've got it, but I shouldn't have had to pay for it. Also, you absolutely should not have to pay for an HTTPS connection for anything. That should just be basic user service.
Right.
So I call upon Feedly as a lifetime member to move that into the free tier. There are plenty of other great things that you can add to this. Maybe you start adding some ads into the free version and you get it ad-free if you're one of the paying customers, things like that. I have no problem with paying Feedly for a service and having perks, but especially the security one. That shouldn't be in the paper.
I remember Google Reader didn't have search for a very long time, which was very, very confusing. Considering Google's a search company, at least they pretend to be when they're not selling ads. But yeah, these services that you get added on, they seem like things you would want if you were really serious about Google Reader and you use things like Evernote or Share2 and you could add all of those different options. I would think what's going to happen with Feedly Pro features, kind of like cars or military technology, I think some of this stuff's going to trickle down to the free users or the lower tier, and then eventually there'll be more and more powerful things that come to the pro user, because there's no way they can't support security, HTTPS, or have a search for the free users. It just seems like it would be hamstringing this free function for no real reason other than money.
Other than money. Money makes the world go round. All right, let's take a quick break. And speaking of money, thank our sponsor, because without their money, we couldn't do the show. This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock.com, what they do is say, look, we've got all these great photographers out here in the world making great photography. They want to get a little money. You probably need some great images for your website, and you don't want to get sued or lose a lot of money or spend a lot of money, let's bring all these folks together. So Shutterstock goes out. It finds professional photographers and artists. They review each image individually for content and quality before adding it to its library. But they still add more than 10,000 images every day. So every time you visit, you find something new. They make an amazing search engine. So if you're like, I just want something that shows sad, you can actually, there's an emotional search engine. You can search for moods. You can search by color. You can drill down by subject, asset type, gender, and more. And you can save things into a light box, which you can share with other users. So if you've got a team working on a project, it's great to throw some stuff in there. You can all decide which images you think work best. And then once you're ready to buy, you just pick one of their packages, whether you want to have pay by the piece, or when you want to have like 25 pieces a month if you're using a lot of stuff. No credit card needed to try it, though. So try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. Just start an account, begin using it. Maybe open one of those light boxes and start collaborating. Once you decide to purchase, though, use the offer code TNT8 and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com for 30% off new accounts. Use offer code TNT8. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Tech News Today. I use them all the time on It's a Thing to find that perfect image to go along with the episode on when we post it to the blog. All right. Eric and Marcus, we talked about in the news fuse, arrested on charges of being the largest facilitator of child porn on the planet. He faces up to 30 years in prison if he were found guilty. He is the alleged founder, as we mentioned, of Freedom Hosting. And he's got a court date on Thursday in Ireland for extradition. Freedom Hosting, Tor Mail, Onion Bank, all offline. And it looks like it's from a JavaScript injection. Now, the FBI isn't saying they're the ones that did it, but we can put two and two together. JavaScript injected in web pages, possibly exploiting Firefox 17 ESR. That's the extended support version of Firefox. So if you're like, wait a minute, Firefox is up to 20, right? No wonder Tor is messed up. They were using the extended support on purpose. That's what's meant for enterprises so that they don't have to keep changing their system to figure out all the updates. It's supposed to be secure. So if, Mozilla is actually looking into this. That is the browser in the Tor browser bundle for Windows. It looks like, according to all the stuff we're reading, mounted a correlation attack from an IP address, a Verizon business IP address, somewhere outside of Washington, D.C. And if you don't know how this works, it's kind of a dark net. You have to be using Tor. And then for the Freedom Hosting, you would access .onion extensions. Or you could go to tor2web.org to access this sort of stuff. Hidden services were used by news agencies. Apparently, The New Yorker uses this. It was used by governments. It was used to get around government filters. But it was also used by folks who don't do nice things, like child pornography. Anonymous actually was upset about this. They were targeting the child pornographers on Freedom Hosting. They DDoSed Freedom Hosting because of this. So it's not a simple like, well, it's the feds on one hand and the freedom fighters of the internet on the other. How do we feel about this? On the one hand, child porn ring possibly busted. That's not a bad thing. On the other hand, the feds penetrating Tor makes a lot of people who already feel pretty insecure on the internet these days feel even more secure. How do you feel about this, Chris?
Well, you know, this isn't the first time we've seen a bust on Tor, and it certainly won't be the last. But I think that, we can't say that we have an expectation that the government should treat Tor or any other darknet or secure service with kid gloves and pretend like they're not going to try to get into it, right? And so I think that if anyone using Tor is under the impression that they are safe from being targeted by authorities, they are sorely, sorely mistaken. And even in situations where the security is very, very good with some of these services, it won't be for long. I mean, I think that it's a mistake to ever underestimate the capabilities of the NSA or other government organizations who are frankly hiring some of the world's smartest hackers. And this appears to be a pretty sophisticated attack on the browser bundle. And I'm sure it's not going to be the last time we see it.
When you use services like this or you're using anything that's you're supposed to be encrypted or whatever, it all it seems to do is buy time before you're found mm-hmm. out. And the government's got tons of resources to go into this. The fact that they do hire hackers all the time, that they first they're like, hey, we're going to arrest you. And they're like, oh, do you want to cop a plea and maybe work for us? Because this kind of information, while I wouldn't say secure, it's like temporarily secure for now. But to bust this kind of thing, I think it'll bust a lot of people's ideas of what's anonymous and what's not. Because I think, oh, the Onion router, I can do whatever I want. It's like, no, not necessarily. If you're doing really bad stuff like this, you're going to get caught. The question is, what's really bad stuff? People are afraid that, oh, if I'm downloading a movie, am I going to get busted for that? Or is something as vile as what this fellow was doing?
Yeah, it's sort of hard to argue with, well, for me anyway. It's like the authorities shouldn't be in this business because so many of us aren't doing anything wrong. Well, very small number of people who are the bad guys and gals do things like this. So it's like, if this isn't a great opportunity for people who are in law enforcement to try to get rid of them, you know, I don't know what is. It's, you know, this is the same thing with, well, we're trying to find the terrorists. Okay, well, most of us aren't terrorists and we feel violated. Well, but every once in a while we do find them. So do you want us to just not try? They're trying.
they didn't get Tor's cooperation on this. I suppose one could make the argument that this shows that the feds can catch people without relying on court orders for surveillance. They can just go in and do their stuff themselves. I don't know. I don't know that that's illegal either, to just go and do a JavaScript injection on something like Freedom Hosting. Well, I'd be interested to see how that plays out in this court case.
But think about like Stuxnet, for instance, which is probably the most famous example of a worm that has been, you know, widely considered to be tracked back to U.S. hackers working at the government level. This is not the end. This is just the beginning, and I think we're going to see them get sophisticated just as quickly as the Black Hat hackers do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right about that. Let's talk about something cheerier. Making money off your car that you're not driving.
This is a somewhat bizarre service. Flight Car is what it's called, and it allows you to rent out your unused car. Now, we've talked about services like this in the past. Get Around is another one that comes to mind. Flight Car is more specific, though. And in fact, it's only in the San Francisco and Boston area right now because it actually will store your car in a garage that belongs to Flight Car near the airport, the international airports, Logan International and SFO, in the Bay Area. So for at least 30 days, when you decide, okay, I want to rent out my car, your car can be rented out to people visiting the area or people who just live in the area. It doesn't have to be anybody who's coming in on a plane, although it's set up to be near the airport for that reason. Somebody's, you know, lands in San Francisco and they might want to rent your car rather than use a rental car. Now, as the owner, if you say, oh gosh, 15 days in, I still want to use my car, you can do that. If it's not already reserved, you can go ahead and basically reserve it, or you can give them a heads up of about 5 hours and you'll get a ride to get to your car. The problem is at least for San Francisco, I mean, I happen to live in part of San Francisco that's not too far away from the airport, but certain parts of the city are very far. And if you live in the suburbs of any kind that are, you know, on the other side, you know, you've got a bridge, you've got the bay, it's a huge pain in the butt to get yourself down to near the airport in order to get your car back, because you still have to get yourself there. Do we think that this is a good idea when there are other services that don't have that whole airport component involved? It does say if you have a luxury car and it's newer than 2008, you can earn up to $400 a month, which is pretty good pocket change.
Well, I actually used GetAround.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so I and, you know, the airport part aside of this, I can say that it was end-to-end a terrible experience, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone because I think they guaranteed at that time, I'm in Chicago, and they launched a pilot here for their getaway service where you give it to them for, I think, a minimum of 6 months, and then you can either renew it or get the car back. And it's kind of the same deal where they put it in their garage. They fit the car with a kit that allows it to be started with a card like Zipcar. And the problem with it is when I got it back, first of all, over the course of it being leased out, I got several red light camera tickets.
Uh-huh.
And that was a huge pain to get those resolved. They GetAround does pay for them, but they weren't really responding to my communications, and they were basically paid at the last minute before I was going to get, you know, into a bunch of trouble with the city. So, but finally that got resolved. And then when I got the car back, it just reeked of smoke. And I'm a non-smoker. I can't stand smoke. And it was just disgusting. So then I took it in to get it detailed, and now my car just smells like a rental car, which is even more disgusting. So the bottom line is that for me anyway, I would definitely not recommend this, even though they'll come and pick you up and let you use your car if you want to. It's just not worth it. It really isn't.
And how far from O'Hare do you live? I mean, that seems like it would be really inconvenient when you did need the car.
Yeah, because traffic, I'm downtown. So the traffic on that route, 9094 out to O'Hare, can be a complete nightmare. Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, the company says all vehicles will receive $1 million in insurance, so it should cover anything if, you know, in an unlikely event that something terrible happens, you're covered, and all renters are screened before they rent a car, and Flight Car says that cars will only go 1,200 miles per month. If it exceeds that number, you as the owner will get compensated per mile, but it doesn't account for somebody being a bad driver, you know, or smoking or just being gross. And then you know that they've been in your car and it's like, ugh. You know, I mean, that it turns into a huge hassle because then you've got some bone to pick with the company because your car might smell, for example. And that's not really what the insurance is supposed to cover.
Yeah, when I heard about the story, I was reading it this morning. I was like, oh, this seems like a really good way to make money while I have to go on a long-term trip, leave my car at the airport or flight car or whatever it is. And then somebody else can rent it instead of me paying long-term parking. Somebody else can, I can make money off of it. And then Chris goes ahead and bursts my bubble entirely going, oh, you never know what kind of jerk is going to be in your car messing it up. So I guess that in theory, good idea, but in practice, I guess you're right. You never know what somebody's going to do to your car until they get into it. Because as far as they're concerned, they're like, I don't care about this car. This is the one I'm using.
Right.
And I mean, I hardly care about mine. So you can imagine how bad it would be if somebody else was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think, if I were to do this, it would have to be a car that I've kind of given up on. Like instead of trading it in, I just go park it at the airport and see if it can make some money that way. If it does get smoky or something, it doesn't end up being a problem. But you would think that a service like this would detail these cars every once in a while anyway, because as a renter, I wouldn't want that car to smell like smoke. That would not be a pleasant situation. Someone in the chat room was asking if they detail them themselves, if they clean it out after renters, all that sort of thing. So lots of questions there. GM, on the other hand, trying to make it easy to do these sort of things by changing your car into kind of an app platform, I asked.
Yeah, so GigaOm took a look at GM's plan to make a more connected car. And they talked to GM's developer of ecosystem, Nick Pudar. And he said that GM is pretty much removing the smartphone from the development equation. It appears that after 2015, all GM model cars 2015 and later will be equipped with an LTE chip that connects to the AT&T network. And GM is going to have this app platform because it's going to have one operating system powering all its cars. Right now, they have several different ones that power Chevy MyLink, the Cadillac Q, IntelliLink. They're all based on different things. That's going to get simplified down to one. They'll still have different brand names, but the apps will be specific. Will actually be available for all, that is. GM is going to give developers access to infotainment systems, so like radios and all that fun stuff, but also access to telematics. So it'll know about speed. It'll be able to unlock your car if you wanted to. Developers can build apps apart from the car as well, so you can unlock the car if you wanted to with an app that way. You can tell if somebody's driving your car, how fast it's going. So this might be useful for that flight car thing, if you could actually track what the other person is doing. You can set all kinds of things when you go to your car per user. Let's say Sarah was going to borrow my car. It could have different settings for the chair or the radio stations. All that kind of stuff could be built in. But GM says its app store is going to be curated. Now, each app has to pass two specific guidelines, has to meet the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's guidelines for distracted driving, which means no like crazy full screen videos or things that distract the driver. And every app has to be upfront about what information it's collecting on the user. GM cars are going to be messing with this around 2015, maybe a little earlier than that. But these are going to be baked into the car, so they're not going to be smartphone dependent. Chris, is GM making a mistake? Because hardware moves so fast in the mobile space. If they have this car you buy in 2015, by 2017, are you going to think about upgrading your car, or are you going to be like, well, this is not going to work?
Yeah, and to be honest, I think that might be part of the strategy here. I'm a little disappointed that they're going this way. I really believed that what we were seeing happen, and you know, GM already does this in like the Chevy Spark. They rely very heavily on the smartphone to present the driver with an in-car entertainment and navigation experience. And we saw Apple demonstrate tighter car integration in iOS 7, right? At the event at WWDC. And it makes so much sense to do that, because then the user only needs to learn one UX, and that's the UX of their phone. And it's a very natural extension to walk into your car. The phone already does all of these things. So you just pop it into a slot, or even you just keep it in your pocket and connects over Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. And the car does everything that it needs to do through your smartphone. Anyone who cares about these kinds of services is going to own a smartphone anyway. So I do think that there is some semblance of planned obsolescence on GM's part here. And I'm a little disappointed that they're going this way.
I think they want to try the efficiencies of that Apple model, though, of curating it. And it will be interesting to see if that ends up having enough positive benefits to make it work for them. I want cars to do all this sort of thing, but I think IaaS, you know, brings up a good point, is when you buy a car, those features are not new for very long in the lifetime of the car. I mean, I usually drive a car for, you know, more than 5 years. And so my car, I don't even have an aux jack on my car. How do I live, right? I mean, that's so this is, who knows what cars are actually going to be featuring by the time this app platform becomes 5 years old. And 5 year old operating systems don't even get supported on most smartphones. So what are they going to do about backwards compatibility and support and all of that sort of thing?
The other thing is, I don't really know how they can get developers to make apps specific for this car. So if you're going to make apps and they're working with smartphones and then there's an extension into the car, that makes more sense. But if you're like, oh, I'm a developer, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make GM apps for the rest of my life, just doesn't seem like something that I would see a ton of independent developers doing. Maybe larger companies will support, you know, everything. But it seems a little strange to me. And it's like, if you had like an evolution kit like they have on the Samsung TVs where you can pop out a piece and upgrade it, you wouldn't want to do that either because you would just have your smartphone. So it seems a little odd to me.
Not to mention security. When they're giving apps access to telematics, you better be really sure that you have a firewall between those apps and the internet and what the car's steering and acceleration can do. All right, let's move on to the randomizer. We were running a straw poll today, and looking at the results now, it looks like in third place was Japan's launching a talking humanoid robot into space. In second place, these are actually pretty close. In second place with 38% of the vote was the test tube burger, the $380,000 test tube grown meat burger that was eaten by the critics. They said it was very lean. The one we're going to talk about, the winner, is simple technique to put graphene capacitors on par with lead acid batteries. It's actually a way to make individual ions that absorb to an electrode in a wash, basically. You just wash the graphene with the ions at the same time that you're manufacturing them. So theoretically, it could be used by the same kind of equipment that's used to make paper. So we could just roll off sheets of graphene that are actually on the low end, but still as capable of a charge as a lead acid battery, which is the kind of batteries most cars used to have in them.
Why aren't we talking about the test tube burger?
Well, I'm looking at the poll right now. I see 44 votes with test tube burger and 41 for graphene. So maybe Tom's got an outdated straw poll up right now.
Yeah, Tom.
Unless you wanted graphene to win, because you always want to talk about graphene.
Did I get cross-eyed on that? I sure did. Let's talk about the test tube burger.
Yeah.
Stricken from the record.
380,000 bones, y'all. And it supposedly was not very good.
It was lean, they said.
Well, they said it felt as if there wasn't a lot of fat, which contributed to it not tasting very good. Mm-hmm. But that the consistency seemed on par. And that there was no unpleasant smell from the crowd. There were only two people who got to taste it.
Yeah, it was critics, right?
Yeah, two lucky critics were able to taste.
It cost $325,000 to produce, financed entirely by Google co-founder Sergey Brin. Wow. To have that kind of money just to make a burger, $325,000 for a burger, that's not that good.
Sergey Brin not only spent $380,000 on a burger, but then he didn't even eat it.
Well, he's got some money to spare.
Tiny bit.
This raises some interesting dilemmas for vegetarians, does it not?
Well, dilemmas or solutions? It depends, right? Yeah. I think a lot of them are going to have a dilemma. I know that some vegetarians are very supportive of this because their problem is with cruelty, and so vat-grown meat is perfectly fine. Others say, no, it's all the idea of meat, et cetera, et cetera. It's got a long way to go before they really have to deal with that dilemma, though.
Yeah, I mean, look at the price just to start things out here. I mean, you take a piece of tissue from a deceased cow and use, you know, stem cells to grow a burger, and it costs almost $400,000. That's not a very good sustainable model.
Yeah, so you can go into space.
But it points to the possibilities in the future. You don't have to clear cut as many rainforests to herd cattle in order to feed people. That's a good thing.
How much water does it take to produce one of these things? That's usually the metric, right? When it comes to farm animals and such things. Kind of curious about that. But $325,000, that's like a couple of Teslas. Yeah. Think of it that way.
It's like a dinner for two at the French Laundry. Right.
This will be on the menu there post-haste.
That's right.
All right, let's take a quick break and thank our last sponsor for today's show. Last but certainly not least, Ting. Ting is a no BS mobile service. It's an MVNO. That means that you're using the Sprint network in this case. You're using another network, but they give you a great deal. all these guys talking about no contracts, no early termination fee. Ting's been doing that forever, and it's true. There's no, oh, it's no contract, really, sort of. You buy your phone, you're done. And you pay for what you use. There's no bundling. There's no ride-along services. There's no overage charges. There's no penalties where it's like, hey, I got to guess what I'm going to be doing this time. And then, oh, I guessed wrong, so I'm going to get a charge. No mysterious line items on your bill. Unlimited devices on one plan, too. So that's the best part. In my opinion, if you've got a family plan, this is the greatest thing ever because you just buy the devices for the family and then you use the plan. And then you say, well, however much we use, that's what we pay. You don't have to say, oh, I'm going to buy the expensive family plan because I want to make sure we don't get any overage. No, it doesn't work that way. Plus, no hold customer support. You call them 1-855-TING-FTW anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A real person picks up the phone. If you have a problem outside of those times, help.ting.com has an active customer forum, simple and powerful help ticketing system, video tutorials, video startup guides, and much more. You purchase your mobile device from Ting. You'll get it in 2 to 5 days. Then you activate your device with Ting, have the option to select a new phone number or port your existing one, and Ting will break your rates out by minutes, text messages, and megabytes and bill you at the end of the month for only what you've used. So there's no like, hey, this is free, but we're actually overcharging you over here. Save money and better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting at tnt.ting.com. They have a savings calculator right there. So you can put in, okay, here's my current plan. What would the same plan be like on Ting? Compare and decide for yourself. Tech News Today viewers also save $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. So visit tnt.ting.com and start saving today. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
We've got a voicemail about local search. Let's take a listen.
Hey there. In the talk about Google getting into local search more, or if anybody can get into local search, who can do it, I was reminded of the feature that's been sitting on my phone going unused for a while, the Lumia 920 and Windows Phone and their Local Scout. When I heard your discussion, it reminded me to give it a go, and it works pretty well. I was traveling in a city I've never been in before, and with the push of a single button, I see all these events near me, attractions near me, other events going on, deals near me, and all sorts of other local news and everything else. So definitely don't count out Microsoft and what they have going on with their local search right now. So who knows? Maybe if they could automate that in a way, kind of like Google does with Google Now, maybe that could be a pretty killer feature. Anyway, thanks for the show. Bye.
Interesting slip of the tongue there, comparing Microsoft and Nintendo. But what do you guys think? Local Scout to me sounds more like Foursquare or something like that, and less like Google Now, but I don't know.
It's kind of like Foursquare, Explore, or using like the Yelp monocle kind of thing, trying to see what's going on around the area. But Bing Local is actually pretty good compared to a lot of other services. So we got a lot of emails about Local Search, or Local Scout, that is, from Windows Phone.
All right, let's move on to the emails. What you got, Ayaz?
Sure, we've got an email from Spare Parts Paul. He says, hey, TNT, in regards to the subject of Nintendo's future and survival in the game industry, I think they'd be successful making their own gaming tablet. Just think, a Wii Tab running new and classic Nintendo games on their own OS, downloadable from their own app store, and capable of streaming to your smart TV. Side note, Google should buy Ouya and turn the Nexus Q into a relevant game system. Love the show. Nintendo tablet, anybody? Does that sound like a good idea?
I think Nintendo needs to admit that it's just not very good at making hardware and that it's excellent at carrying forward the legacy of its excellent library and cast of characters, and it just needs to farm out to other platforms. Guys who are better at making hardware and better at making operating systems, because the Wii U has been basically an unmitigated disaster for the company, at least so far. And my understanding is that it's still kind of slow, needs another update this fall. Right. I would not be very excited about a Wii Tab.
I would call it a mitigated disaster. Like, yeah, you could actually still play some games on it.
True.
They just have to change the name.
But mostly it's a disaster.
Don't call it Wii anything, because the Nintendo 3DS and 3DS XL and all those things, that naming convention means that this is an upgrade on the 3DS. By having the Wii and the Wii U, it just sounds like it's an upgrade, a partial upgrade. And it's that name that's messing with it. Why not just revive the Revolution brand that they had as a code name, which was awesome, and just call something the Revolution and just come up with like a round system? There you go. There's a stupid idea for you.
All right. Well, that is it for the show today. Chris Ziegler, a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for coming, man. I hope we can have you back.
Absolutely. And thank you.
Let folks know, obviously, they find your work at The Verge, but where can they follow you on Twitter? Anything else you got going on you want to tell us about?
Twitter is Z Power, or as Dieter Bohn would say, Zed Power. If you're Canadian or English, that will sound more familiar to you. And then I'm also at blog.ziglerc.net.
Yes, and happy Civic Day or Provincial Day or Heritage Day. It's a holiday in Canada. They've got like 17 different names for it up there, but nice. I hope you're having a good
happy day to you.
And thank you, Chris. Great having you on. Don't forget about our subreddit, T at technewstoday.reddit.com. That's where we solicit your input on what stories we should cover every day. It's not the only source we look at, but it's one of the most important sources we look at to see what are people interested in us covering. We want to see what those Redditors have to say. It's very important to us. So go in there and submit and vote. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us. Our email address is tnt@twit.tv. And you can give us a call and leave us a voicemail like we had today, 260-TNT-SHOW. Sharif Stark from Engadget joins us tomorrow. We'll see you then. Well done.
Woo! Medium rare, everybody.
I enjoyed it.